Okay, so just to show for a moment, we have done. You guys, I have not really brought it up so much, but we have, we spend a lot of time on the Seder's different aspects. We took a couple of detours on, Yom HaZikaron, Yom HaAtzmaut, and now we're up to Mishpat, which is civil law. After the Jews received the Aseret Dibros, the first thing they dealt with was the civil law, which of course question, which of course it's intrinsically is a question in its own right, is why are the Mishpatim first? So Max, you're back. You get to read the Midrash.
Hey, Rabbi Yehuda, the prince, editor of the Mishnah, said, just as the Holy One, blessed be He, warned the Jewish people about observing the Ten Commandments, so too did He warn them concerning the civil and monetary law. Why? Because the whole world is dependent on it. As the verse in Proverbs 29:4 states, the king by justice establishes the land.
Okay, so the Midrash is concerned about, is asking a basic question. You have the Aseret HaDibros, and then you've got literally three chapters of a variety of civil law. So that's itself the question. Why is that first? And then Rabbi Yehuda says, well, very simple. Just as God warned Jewish people the Ten Commandments, He warned them because of all the Mishpatim, the civil and monetary law, because the entire world depends upon it. As the verse in Proverbs says, the king by justice established the land. Okay? So let's get a couple of questions here. Number one, why is justice, including civil and monetary laws, contingent on first internalizing the first two Dibrot? First two Dibrot, what's the first Dibrot? What's the first of the Ten Commandments?
I am the Lord your God.
I am the Lord your God, I brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of slavery, which is a mitzvah to know, believe, affirm that God exists. Number one. What's the second Dibra?
You shall not have any gods or idols before me.
The prohibition of idolatry. You shall not have any other gods before me. Correct. Well done. So why is justice contingent? Notice the civil law is not first, even though the whole world depends upon it. It's after the Ten Commandments. So question number one is, why is the Dibros, specifically the first two, first and then extended out with the civil law? What do you guys say?
Because to have the civil law, you
Okay,
require.
we got a Zoom live thing. So we're gonna go with live first, and then we're gonna go to Zoom. So Adrian, speak loud. Foundation.
Morality or morals codified and uniform manner. And so if you keep digging down to the foundation, you need a belief system. Otherwise, you end up with bad relativism. So
Okay.
it's the difference between morality and ethics.
Okay. So just to, and I, were we able to hear that in Zoom? A little bit. Okay. So just to, so just this, Adrian said that all law, morals, and ethics are built upon a foundation. And the foundation of Judaism is God and the rejection of non-God. Okay? So therefore, if you don't have God, then you're just gonna have civil law. You'll have a law like you have in Europe. They don't really believe in God, but they have law. And then it becomes like, well, then you're gonna have to utilitarianism, you're going to have to go social contract, social contract, all the different kinds of methodology. Now, let's get to the key question here, which we're getting toward the substance of our class tonight. Why is the world dependent on civil and monetary law? What does the Midrash really mean by the whole world is dependent upon it?
Money makes the world go round,
And that's true, money makes, but how does, but why civil law? Why is the whole world dependent upon civil law? What is the basic sense? And it's also from the basic point of the Midrash. Okay,
For example,
was that okay? Which is?
there wasn't any law, even in the Exodus, people would eat
Yeah, so Adrian pointed out the Pirkei Avot says, we pray for the government, for the king, because without which man would swallow up his friend. Now, without even a tyrannical government is better than anarchy, because with no government, you have basically man versus man, the worst nightmares you can imagine. So the world is dependent upon Montreal in the sense that what? That in order to have good civil society, a society where people can grow, humanity can grow, you need to have that everybody treats each other with at least justice, if not with dignity. Okay, you know what I mean? At least fairly, if not with dignity. Okay, and that's the pri- and that's why it's first. In fact, another Pirkei Avot, Derech Eretz Kadma L'Tara, that basic civility, basic kibbutz, kavod abrios is prior to Torah. In other words, if you're not a, to put it in simple language, you got to be a mensch first. Mensch first, Torah is a enhancement of that. But if a person's not a mensch, if a person's a devious person, then the Torah really can't help them. It's not going to go anywhere. Okay? Now, with that backdrop, I'm going to give, what we're going to do today is, and this is a distinction between Jewish law and American law. In Judaism, every child from age 5 learns civil law. What do I mean? Because if you learn the Parsha Mishpatim, you're going to learn about the responsibility of being a watchman. What are your basic duties? Oh, if you make a pit in the public domain, issues of damages, fiscal responsibility, paying your workers on time. That's not something that only lawyers and judges learn. It's what every Jew has to know. Okay? We don't view that civil law is a specialty phenomenon. Now, there is a specialty. I'm not saying everybody has to become a rabbi, okay? But I'm saying that every Jew has to be literate in this level. Now, it's in the Torah. It's not for special Jews. It's for all Jews. Pirkei Avot says, what's the basic Jewish curriculum? Bein chamesh l'mikra. At age 5, the child starts learning the scripture. We call learning the Chumash, learning the Parsha. And you go from Breishit till Zot HaBaracha, and everything, and you don't skip, okay? And then, Bein Esther LeMishnah. At 10 years old, he learns the Mishnah. What is Mishnah? Case law. What is he, a lawyer? Yes, every Jew's a lawyer, okay? Because you can't function, what I'm going to prove tonight, you cannot function as a good Jew unless you know what to do, not just in the shul, but in business, and backing your car up into your friend's car, or, because that is something which is critical. So what we're going to do tonight, I have three cases. We're going to analyze it. And I don't look at the answers. Our goal is we're going to read the case. We're going to discuss the case. You're going to tell me what should be done. And then we're going to see what the dayan, the judge, said. And in doing so, we're going to learn some basic practical monetary law that applies in our life. And just to give you sort of a sense of what's going on, if I feel that we have a successful session tonight, I might do another bunch of cases next week. We'll see how it goes. We're trying it out. Something new. Okay. And before I get into the, we'll get to, of course, you said I'm going to shortchange you with the video. I know Scott's saying, where's the video? Where's the video? It's coming. I don't have to do the video first, do the video second. Okay, just moving things around. Okay, we're getting there. Don't worry. I will not disappoint. There's always a video component of the class. Okay, so question number 3, as a person becomes more committed in their Judaism, what should they stress or try to balance? The ritualistic mitzvot, Shabbat, Kashrut, Tefillah, or the monetary laws? Based upon what we have read, what would you say?
Shabbat, Kashrut, and Tefillah?
Now why? What's your argument for that? Does it mention, is Kashrut mentioned in the Ten Commandments? No. Kashrut, by the way, is mentioned in the Mishpatim. It's mentioned one pasuk. It's in there, but it's not. Is Tefillah mentioned there? Is Tefillah mentioned in the Aseret Dibros? It is not. Civil law. Basically, laws between a person and their fellow. We're going to, you know, monetary damages, all these kind of things. Contract law, we're going to get to that. So we're going to deal with three cases, and we're going to start off with a video. So let's go, as they say, let's go to the videotape. A mishpat is a kind of mitzvah. Mitzvah is a general term. And then a mitzvah is a general term. And then you have three kinds of mitzvot. You have a mishpat, which is a civil law between a person and his friend. A chok, which is a law whose reason is not readily known. And third is a edut, mitzvahs that testify. Like Shabbat testifies God is a creator. Sukkot testifies that God took care of the Jews in the desert. Pesach is a edut mitzvah because God liberated the Jews from Egypt. Okay, so three kinds of mitzvot. Edut from the word testimony. Testimonies. Okay, three kinds of laws. Mishpatim, chukim, edut. Okay, all right, here we go. Here we go to the, let's go to the videotape here. No videotape anymore. That itself is an anachronism. Okay, here we go. Okay, mini bar cocktails. Here we go.
Don't think about it.
Does that not make you want a cocktail like right now? Okay. Just give you some cocktail envy? All right. So the question is, what does the guy do with anything? So what is going on? Right. Now, has everybody here been to a hotel room with the hotel minibar? And have you ever been in that situation where basically you're in your PJs, it's like 11 o'clock at night, you don't want to go outside, go down the block, but rather you really want to just go and take the, this $8 Pringles or the $15 little bottle of Johnny Walker Red and the $9 Coke, right? But what's the struggle there? What's the struggle?
It's so overpriced.
Right. You know you're getting ripped off because they know they got you because it's late and you're just exhausted and you don't want to get out of bed. But on the other hand, it's like right there. They have like all the treats. They have chocolate and they got Pringles, always Pringles. Something about the Pringles.
Chips
they love the Pringles. I don't know what. All right. And all the stuff is, you know, with a wonderful like 700% markup. Okay. So this is the exact conflict that this particular person that we're going to title number one of look at. We're going to go to case number one. Those people have the sheet. I'm going to show it on the screen momentarily. And here we go. And we're going to have somebody read the case. Let's have. And don't look at the answer. Okay, that takes away the thing. All right, Anna, you get to read. Anna. Evan. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Dad, you're going to be next. Go on.
Okay, Cape Swan Hotel Minibar. The Metzgers were spending the weekend in a hotel. They arrived Thursday night, and by the time they unpacked and settled in, it was already 10 p.m. "I'm very thirsty," Mrs. Metzger said. "I could use a cold drink." "There's a mini bar in the room," replied Mr. Metzger. "There should be drinks in it." Mrs. Metzger opened the mini bar. "The mini bar is stocked with water, soda, and juice," she said happily. She then noticed the price list placed conspicuously nearby. "Wow, a small bottle of water, soda, or juice costs $4, she exclaimed. "That's double what it costs in a store." "It's already late," replied Mr. Metzger. "We're not going out to a store now, and ordering a drink will cost even more. Take what you want, I'll share it with you, or drink tap water." Mrs. Metzger chose a bottle of juice and drank it. The following day, the Metzgers went for a walk around town. It was a warm day, so they stopped at a store to buy drinks. Mrs. Metzger noticed the bottle of juice identical to the one from the hotel for $2. "We can buy a bottle of juice here and replace the one we took last night," she said to her husband. "That would be much more economical." "I don't think the hotel would approve of that," replied Mr. Metzger. "I heard that some hotels even have sensors that register when you remove items from the fridge and bill you automatically." "What's the difference to the hotel?" said Mrs. Metzger. "We leave the fridge stocked like we found it. They don't lose anything. Anyway, they have no right to charge such high prices. It's probably considered unfair pricing." "Oh, nah. I would check with Rabbi Dayan first," replied Mr. Metzger. "I don't want to do anything dishonest." He called Rabbi Dayan and asked, "Can I replace the bottle of juice in the minibar with one from the store?"
Okay, stop right there. All right, that's the case. Now, don't look at the answer. What do you guys say? You're going to say why.
I mean, honestly, I would really do it, but I think
it's probably okay. So you're saying that it's not the right one. So what issue is there?
They're stealing.
I want to look at that. The people online can't hear you guys. So I'm going to go people live and then alternate to Zoom people. Back Asha. Right. Right. Chloe brings up a very good point. The price is not, they basically are, you are paying. The price is the price for the bottle of juice or whatever it may be, and you are paying for the convenience. You don't have to step out of your hotel room, and that's why it's $4 or $8 or $12, whatever it is. Okay, good. Did you look at, don't, long as long you didn't look at the answer. What do you say?
Price. You accept the offer.
By what?
By taking it, you accepted the offer, and you were contractually obligated at that point.
Immediately at that point.
When you took it, you accepted the offer, so that there's a binding contract.
Okay.
With payment due later.
Right. So, Adrian, we have counsel. We have legal counsel here tonight. Says very simply. Fundamentally, it's not simply you taking the bottle of juice. You pick the juice up. That's why there's a sensor. You have now accepted the deal. There's a contract. What's the contract? You want the juice? Is the price? You pick it up. You take it. You bought it, and that immediately, and by tomorrow, that'll be on your credit card. If not, immediately. Either somewhere between immediately or by tomorrow morning, your card. That you put for your, what they call for the, what's that term they use? The thing? For the incidentals, okay, will be charged. And that's it. So therefore, the fact that you're putting the identical bottle of juice in is irrelevant, because that's not the bottle. You bought it. It's game over. Okay? So let's, Anna, keep on going. You're going to read the answer there.
Replacing the juice from the minibar with a bottle from the store is cheating the hotel, replied Rabbi Dayan. When you took the bottle of juice, you effectively bought it from the hotel. As such, you are required to pay them according to their set price. Shulchan Aruch writes that one who buys something must pay the seller with money, not commodities.
Right. So therefore you say, oh, so I'll pay him back. I won't pay him for $4. I'll pay him back with the exact same item. So the Shulchan Aruch, now the CM stands for Choshen Mishpat. The Shulchan Aruch, which is the code of Jewish law, you guys heard of that, has four sections. Orach Chaim, which is like daily life, which is, you know, the all things, regular Jewish law, Shabbat, Brachot, Davening, all the holidays, that's in section one of the Shulchan Aruch. The section that deals with all civil law, contracts and damages and all that kind of stuff, is in Choshen Mishpat, which means literally, Choshen Mishpat is what the Kohen Gadol wore, the breastplate of justice. So they call that section Choshen Mishpat. So the Shulchan Aruch says openly, basically what Dadrin said, you took it, you bought it, and you owe him cash. And you can't pay it back with another bottle identical.
They wanted to give one bottle. That's not the equivalent of the prize that was being
correct. Charged. Correct.
So the hotel can accept something. It might be another law, but it's not necessary to resolve this case.
Well, he's saying number one is that you bought it. To do that is cheating. Point one. Point two, you can't say, well, I'm paying them. No, you're not paying them because the deal was, you take the juice, you give us the cash. That's it. That's the deal. You can't make your own deal. No, I'm going to pay back with identical thing of juice. No, that wasn't deal. They don't want your pakakta bottle of juice. They want the money. So that gets the next paragraph. Anna Babakarsha, keep on going.
According to many authorities, this applies even if the customer does not have money to pay with. He is required to sell his commodities to raise cash, unlike a borrower, who can repay with an equivalent value of commodities if he does not have money. This is because the clear understanding and implicit condition is that the seller wants money, not value, in return for his goods.
Okay, keep on going.
Some maintain, however, that if the customer does not have money, he can pay with commodities like a borrower. Even so, if he has money, he must pay with money. Furthermore, even if you could pay with commodities, the purchase price is set at $4, whereas the bottle in the store is worth only $2. So you would have to pay with two bottles. Replacing a single bottle is insufficient payment. We will not address hafkas halvas here.
Okay, fine. I'm not going to get into that either one right now. Go on.
Nonetheless, there is no ona on the hotel.
Okay, ona is a very important word to know. Ona is price gouging. Price gouging. Okay, why not? Go on.
Since the fair price is relative to the context of the sale, in the framework of hotel minibars, $4 for the price is reasonable.
Right, in other words, if you go into a store and they want $1,000 for a chocolate bar, okay, that's price gouging. But if you go to a 7-Eleven and they want to charge you $3 for a chocolate bar, even though that you can go to Costco and buy a big box and your purchasing mom is really $1.10, no, you want the convenience of a 7-Eleven, you're going to pay the premium of the convenience store. Conversely, you want the convenience of the hotel minibar. Price gouging goes relative to the circumstance. Similarly, like people say, like, you ever gone shopping after security in the airport? Every price, everything just went up like 50%. Is that price gouging based upon what you hear? No, because that's what it is, because there's more cost, convenience, the real estate's expensive. You want to buy a banana and they're going to charge you $3? You don't have to have a drink. You don't have to have a drink. I'm just saying, in other words, it's not price gouging when the universal principle is that in this rarefied circumstance. Like, for example, if I go to the most, let's say, the Sheraton's Lounge, okay, and I want to buy a, and I want to have a, a beer, and they're going to charge me $15 for that beer. Is that price gouging? No, because you want that. That's the circumstance, the environment. So the convenience, in other words, price gouging goes, as it says, is relative thing. Now, if they're going to charge you $40 for that, $40 for that bottle of juice, well, that would be price gouging. So it, there's a contextual element there. This itself is the whole idea. Let's finish off the case. Keep on going.
I should add, concluded Rabbi Dayan, that taking a bottle initially without intent to buy it, but rather to use and later replace, is tantamount to theft. That is certainly prohibited.
Go on.
Verdict. A person who takes something from the hotel minibar effectively buys it and is required to pay the hotel the set price. He may not replace the item with an equivalent one from the store.
Okay, so I want, there's two things. There's a specific case about the minibar, but I want to share with you what really, there is a paradigm shift in orientation that this case and the approach to this case really speaks of. And what is that? I want to hear from the people on Zoom. This is a different, this is literally a different mentality. What is what different mentality is this halakhic conversation about the juice and the minibar really articulating?
Rabbi, when you say different mentality, what do you mean? Different from like common? Like
yeah, how the average person maintains it.
Right. Well, that's a little bit about like Mrs. Metzger's mentality, right? Where like the driving principle is sort of economic, right? Like she wants to reduce the cost incurred to her. Whereas the different position as introduced by Rabbi Dayan, right, is sort of like God-driven, in which like a fair, just society is the driving principle in producing the consequences.
100%. In other words, you have to start breaking it down to its legal elements, which is what happens when I take the bottle out of the mini bar? What happened? Well, that's it. That is a
Possession of it.
I'm taking possession. I just bought it. I now owe them money, and for me to not pay them the price is stealing. Now people don't feel, in other words, now psychologically, let's say Mr. Metzger did not say anything to Mrs. Metzger. She bought the $2 bottle of juice. She went back into her room. She put the bottle of $2 right in the spot where she got it. She'd walk out. Would she feel bad about herself?
She'd forget about it after like a few minutes.
Right. She'd feel like, she no, beats they, the system. She feels very justified. I no harm, no foul.
She beat the system.
Dead.
Big corporation.
Right.
All right. I'm like, it's not going to make a difference for them if $2 more or $2 less.
Right. She didn't express that in the case, but what Adrian has brought up, there's also people feel the reason why. Now, let me ask a bit more basic question. Why do you think the hotel chains, the Sheratons and the Hiltons, invested in the next generation minibar, where there is a little sensor that as soon as you pick up the thing, boop, it automatically charges your account, like instantaneously? Why do they have to go to that next level, maybe another $1,000 level invested into that minibar? Why do they have to do that?
For the Mrs. Metzgers of the world.
Yeah, because all their hotel people have the mentality of Ms. Metzger's, and Adrian pointed out, because people feel like I'm the little guy and I'm getting shafted by this Hilton. This place is soaking me, man. They're charging me this ridiculous rack rate. Every single the charge here, the charge there, the this fee and that fee. They're nickel and dime, and then they have the chutzpah with their $5 bottle of.
It's just something about them. The mini bar. People don't mind getting a bottle of wine at a restaurant or like a nice steak. but like it's just something about the mini bar and like $5 can of seltzer.
It hits them the wrong way. But so the bottom line is so this mentality is that stealing is stealing whether the person is poor, whether they're middle class, or they're a massive corporation. Okay? So if you have a mishpat orientation, it's irrelevant. Okay? Can't steal. Who cares if they got a lot of money or a little money? Stealing is not based upon weight, it's based upon damage. It's based upon, did I take possession of something that's not mine? In this regard, this is very important. In this regard, the Torah endorses capitalism, that it honors the right of personal property. You own something, it's yours. Nobody can take it away. The taking away of your property is geneva or gazela, is theft or robbery, period.
But is that an endorsement of, maybe I'm quibbling here.
It's an endorsement of that tenet of capitalism.
Of a right to property.
Yes, right.
Gotcha.
And it's emerging from that since you're at Tzelem Elokim, you have a right, God gave us the world, that you have a right to possessions. Hmm. Now, it's not unfettered. Now, again, this week's Parsha, which you'll look at this week at Shul, Bahar B'chokas, Bahar and B'chukotai, deals with all the laws of trying to deal with a concentration of capital among the hands of the few, i.e. that's what the Yovel is about. Yovel is that the nature of money is that it gets quickly concentrated into the hands of very few. Do you know how many families in Israel owe most of the companies?
2%.
Anna has a five. I think it's five or maybe eight. It's small. Because the nature of money is that the wealthy just get wealthier. Okay? And when you have massive capital that gives you a massive advantage and you're a little guy, you can't really do much. So Israeli Jews. No, they're Jews. They're Israeli Jews who've been living there. That's it. So the bottom line is that Shemitah, so the Yovel, basically all the ancestral land that guys have to maybe sell because they were in a bad situation, gets returned. Okay, so it's a reset. It's a capacity to reset. Two is that loans are canceled in the Shemitah year. So unless there's and there was a workaround called the Prusbul, but that was which the rabbis reluctantly did it because the other consequence was worse. All right, I don't want to go into that. All right. I want to go into case number two. This is a roommate dispute. I want to tell you both, all you guys, in MJE, Rabbi Wiles and myself, many MJEers typically live, because to finance living in Manhattan frequently requires a friend, or not a friend, more accurately, a roommate. And disputes are legendary, okay? Legendary, okay? So now this is a case number two of a dispute about furniture, okay? And they wrote the story nicely, but I've had much more negative and nasty stories. Okay, so Max, using your theatrical expertise, give me a nice theatrical rendition of case two, furniture divide. Go on.
We're running away from the theater.
Okay.
Menashe and Ephraim had shared an apartment for the year. When they had moved in, they jointly purchased a computer desk and an eating table. At the end of the year, Menashe wanted to move out to a different apartment. What about the furniture that we bought together? Asked Ephraim. What do you suggest now that we are splitting? I'm staying here, so I'm happy to keep it and pay you half of its value, answered Menashe. I also will need tables in my new apartment, said Ephraim. I'm willing to take them and give you half the value. I think it makes more sense to leave the furniture here, said Menashe. If you insist, though, I don't have any more right than you do. We can do a lottery to determine who gets the furniture, suggested Ephraim. I think it would be simpler if you take one piece and I take the other, Menashe offered. The computer desk and the eating table were both about the same price. But each one serves a different purpose, Ephraim said, I am interested in having both pieces and am willing to buy them both. I would like at least one table, said Manasseh. I'm not willing to sell both tables. We did buy the pieces as partners. I'm happy to remain in partnership. You're the one who's moving. It's within my rights to dissolve the partnership, said Ephraim. I own the tables just as much as you do. That's why I suggest that you take one, Manasseh. I prefer the computer desk. You take the eating table. If I had to choose one, said Ephraim, I would also prefer the computer desk. So that doesn't help. I didn't see that coming. I became invested. The two could not reach a resolution. Each remained adamant in his position, wanting both pieces or at least the computer desk. It was a very nice computer desk. The two decided to approach Rabbi Dayan and asked.
By the way, the play on word, Rabbi Dayan in Hebrew is a judge. So Rabbi Dayan is Rabbi Judge. Okay, that's a little. Okay, so here's the question is, what can we do about dissolving our partnership in the furniture? So without looking forward, don't look at the answer. What do you guys say? What should in other words, they've already done all the obvious stuff. Well, you know, I'll buy you out. No, I'll buy you out. But you take one, I'll take one. Or they did all the obvious solutions have already been worked through. And now it's starting to escalate. Okay, we got a problem. So what do you recommend?
Is it really about the tables, Manasseh and Ephraim? Do you have something else to share?
we're taking right. That's a psychological. They're pretty much focused on that. They both need the tables, and they don't want. That's it. They don't want.
I would say the one who's leaving should pay half the value, because if he's taking them, or you can't leave somebody without, you know, two tables. Like, you're the one second. Leaving.
They bought it 50-50. So let's say each one costs $200, okay? So they have an equal share in the partnership. And no one has a more outstanding claim than the other. The fact that one's leaving, one's going, I don't think that... Well, go ahead.
Nicole in the comments suggested the King Solomon approach, in that you saw them, you start starting at a half and see them stop. I don't know why she didn't say it aloud. It's very good. So I'll share it for her.
Right now, you should know that was Shlomo Melech's ruse to basically smoke out the real mother.
Well, I think it's Malcha Nicole's ruse as well to see who really loves that computer desk.
All right, 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 right.
That's just a nuclear option.
You take the computer desk, I'll take the cash. Right. Right, nobody should have it. If I can't have it, right, exactly. Let it be sawn in half. All right, so
That would be the church's approach. You can't decide, we'll take it.
So what can we, how do you resolve this issue? They both have equal claim. They're both partners. They have a right to dissolve the thing. Each one wants.
The lottery sounded logical.
Right, so you're going to go with the lottery. The lottery. Yeah, they pick.
50-50 shot.
Why? But his leaving, nor there's no dispute about those are other arguments of the lease is up, the guy has a right to leave, everybody's cool. No, there's no dispute about that. They're not saying you're unjustly leaving. Dealt with that before. Okay. We're living together. We're gonna partner on buying these two pieces of furniture. They bought it. They want to split. They want to dissolve the relationship. They tried all the obvious, you'll take one, I'll take one, I'll buy from you, no, you'll buy from me, and they can't work it out. Nope. 1 year lease.
Did they not have a conversation when they were initially going into the partnership about
what prenup.
They
would do?
a computer table prenup.
In case it fails, yeah.
All right, so Anna, first of all, you're bringing up a wise move. In general, the more clear you are with financial arrangements up front, the tsarist at the back end you will save, because when everybody's happy and everybody's, we're going to live together and it's going to be great and everybody's in the love phase. And sure, you know, big TV is going to be over, the bro pal, the brave, it'll be awesome. And then the relationship goes, quack, quack, okay, we're leaving, we're splitting. Okay. No, they didn't do anything. They made none of those. We're partners. I mean, nobody's disputing that they have exactly the same level of ownership, 50-50. All right, so let's go. How does and halacha's designed to deal with all these kind of situations. So let's see how they go with it. All right, next, keep on doing it. Okay.
What does the wise Rabbi Dayan have to say? A partner is entitled to divide at any time unless stipulated or accustomed otherwise, replied Rabbi Dayan. If there are multiple items of the same kind or a single item that is reasonably divisible, each partner takes half.
Okay, so simple case. So, for example, let's say they had a partnership in, you know, they had, you know, 10 cases of high-end beer. So, fine. You take 5 cases, I take 5 cases, we're good. Done. Game over. Simple. So if it's easily divisible, no problem. Okay? But that's not our case. Go on.
When there is a single item that is not divisible, each party can demand goat o agadod.
Goat o agod.
Take or I will take. One sets a price and the other has an option of buying or selling at that price.
Okay, so stop right there. Let's work that out. That means one person has the say, I'm going to set a price. So let's take the computer table for a moment. Guy has to set a price, okay? And then the other guy has a choice either buying or selling at that price.
But didn't they already discuss that and neither of them agreed?
No. They wanted to say, I'll pay, but
like half, like from the original price. So they kind of set a price.
But the price is
the same.
You go above equity, right? You say, I'm willing to give it to you for $300. I'll sell you it at $300
because what happened over the year?
It depreciated,
Has it depreciated?
It's appreciated in sentimental value.
No, it's appreciated for the guy who's staying. Because the hassle of having to go to IKEA, pick out a new thing, have it schlepped to the house, fumble around, try to build it. A little bit will be not right. And because you're Jewish, not always good at putting the stuff together. It's a hassle factor.
The moving roommate seems to be in a similar position as he's willing to pay the cost of the mover.
So then it becomes, as I told this over to my daughter Aviva, she says, Avi, you know what this is? This is simply how I resolve squabbles among children about the problem of this is the cake problem. You know, there is roughly 2 pieces of cake, a large wedge available to the children, or whatever, let's say 3 wedge. So therefore, what's the classic move? You cut and you pick. So when you do that, the kid will have the precision of a laser to cut that slice to ensure that the other sibling does not get 1 crumb more of the other cake.
Uh-huh.
So here too, so let's say you're Menashe, okay? And let's say you're going to be the price setter. You have to cheshbon out, like, what would you pay? What is this computer table worth to you? Well, it originally cost $200, but how much would you buy it for to keep it, to go to your new place or your existing place, whatever, I forgot which one was there, or would you sell for it? So you got to figure out that sweet spot of where that price, like, if you can't give me $300, I'll take the $300 and I'll get myself a new table. But $200, I'd rather have it for $200. So you have to hit that sweet spot to work that out. You got to work out a nice amount, enough that it's that you have to pick that price where if you have to buy it, you would happily buy it because you want the tables. Conversely, and if he's willing to buy, you'd be happy with that buyout. You know what I'm saying? So that's, you have to find that sweet spot. So, all right, keep on going.
The Gemara addresses the case of two similar but distinct items, such as two maidservants.
Different, shall we say, a different world, okay? Lincoln did not show up in the time of the fourth century of another 1300 more years. Go on.
One who cooked and one who sewed. You can't have it all. They are considered different items since each serves a different function, so that one party cannot demand to divide one maid against the other, even if they are worth the same value. Furthermore, one can not demand go to a goat on both maidservants together, but rather on each one separately.
Okay, let's go on.
Here too, the computer desk and eating table are considered different items. One, not unlike slave women. One of you should set a price on either separately, and on one of you should set a price on either separately, and the other can buy or sell at that price. If the two tables were of the same kind, but one was worth more than the other, many authorities maintain that each party can demand through goad or a goad that the other party chooses one table and settles the differential in value. However, some maintain that because of their different values, the tables are considered different items, and the partners should do goad or a goad on each table separately. There is an opinion, concluded Rabbi Dayan, that goad or a goad applies only to partners who jointly inherited an item or received it as a gift, but not to partners who willingly bought an item together. However, almost all authorities maintain that it also applies to partnerships who bought an item together. The verdict being, partners in similar but distinct items can dissolve their partnership through goad or a goad on each item.
Okay. All right. So, Adrian, go ahead, question. Okay, why not?
So the person that needs to set the price, they need to set it sufficiently high so as to, you know, make sure that the other person doesn't buy it.
Yes.
And they're bidding against themselves, and they end up, they end up paying more money. It ends up being a worse deal for them.
So by the way, so I was discussing with Rabbi Yoni Sachs. Adrian pointed out, who has the advantage? The selector has the advantage.
Yeah.
So who has there's a price setter, and then there's a selector, the buy or sell. The price setter. The selector, but that part you resolve by how? Flip. Who's going to have each thing? That's the only way to resolve it. Flip the coin. Who will be what role? But once you have that role, that's the just way of resolving the point. Okay? So that's...
Are you saying that the market maker has an advantage?
Yes. No. The person who has... if you mean market maker, the person who gets to choose... they're going to buy...
The
market maker is
the one setting the price.
He has a disadvantage because he might be he might have to negotiate himself against himself.
Oh, because he's negotiating in an absence of information.
Because whenever you go into a negotiation, we have experts here. Do you want to set the price, or do you want to elicit the person's you want to hear what the person's going to say? By and large, let's say for an apartment. Okay, there's always a. Of negotiation.
No deal for a
Right.
I'm tired.
Right.
So I'm like,
Right.
Right. So what is the number at which you will be happy that you will get that house? And if your offer isn't accepted, you'll say mazel tov to the other.
You're literally doing go-to-go with your client. Right. You're basically saying, right, this is right. This. Right, right, the right. Right. So this is familiar territory. All right. So we're going to now get into actually a real estate I think about accepting offers. Okay. Okay. Literally practical, because God willing, you're going to Okay. So it's Jewish law school. Welcome. I'm your professor. Okay. All right. So let me have somebody. It's better if somebody. Shana Reed, Bavakasha. First off, forget case three.
The Millers were planning to sell their house at the end of the year, but had already begun showing it to people. First to see the house were the Adams. After seeing the house, the Adams said that they were interested in it, but didn't make a concrete offer. Following the Adams, the Borensteins came to see the house. They called back the following day with an offer of $350,000.
Okay, sorry.
We're still in the midst of showing the house to people, said Mrs. Miller. We are not ready to close and finalize a price. The following week, the Cutlers came to see the house. We're willing to offer $330,000, they said on the spot. What do you say? We already received an offer $20,000 higher from someone else, Mr. Miller said. Then we're willing to raise our offer to $360,000, said Mr. Cutler. We'll consider your offer, said Mr. Miller, but we're not ready to commit to that price. Shortly afterwards, the Adams called back. We're still very interested in the house, they said. We'd like to make a concrete offer. We're willing to pay $360,000 for the house. Someone else already offered that amount, said Mrs. Miller. At that price, he should come first. But you said we were the first to see the house, said Mr. Adams. If we're willing to match their offer, we should have priority. We'll consider that, replied Mrs. Miller. Meanwhile, the Borensteins called back and asked whether their offer was accepted. Someone topped your offer by $10,000, Mr. Miller answered. That's no problem, said Mr. Borenstein. We're willing to match that offer. That evening, Mrs. Miller discussed the issue with her husband. At this point, all three couples are offering $360,000, she said. They've got a bidding war. Well, who was first? Asked Mr. Miller. It's hard to say, Mrs. Miller laughed. The Adams saw the apartment first. The Borensteins made the first concrete offer. The Cutlers were the first to offer $360,000. So all three couples were first in one way or another. The Millers decided to call Rabbi Dayan and ask which couple should be given priority.
All right, guys. What did you guys say?
Penny, did you set these up?
What?
Did you write these cases?
No. This is there is a website called the Business Halacha. I'm blanking on the name. This is the Business Halacha Institute. And they have like a Parsha sheet, and one of their components, they always have a business halacha question of the week. This was the numbers 570.
I'm very impressed with how tightly constructed they are. Like someone's been very thoughtful.
Right. Notice that they're alphabetic. Adams, Borensteins, Cutlers, okay, ABC, okay, which is of course always be closing. All right. So so here we have, here's the question. So Adams, let's review. Adams family came, they saw it first, but they didn't know how to do the offer. Then the Borensteins came in, what, with 350. Then the Cutlers came in with 360. Then the Borensteins get up there out of everything. And then Adams joined them at the 360 level. You got three people who have offered $360,000 to your house. And as Mrs. Miller pointed out, they're all first in one category.
One was first to get to that number, 360. how would it go with them?
Does it matter that they were the first to get it? They got to 360 because they were told a couple offered a higher price than their original offer. That's why they went higher.
So let's dissect this. What is the real issue here?
Who has the right to purchase?
Right. Is there a right or a requirement, or we're talking about the Millers? When is the offer binding?
When the deal is signed, the offer is binding.
Okay. So according to that, there's no binding deal here.
I agree. It might leave some bad tastes in somebody's mouth, but ultimately... Right.
There's going to be some unhappy Jews here. There's definitely going to be two families who are unhappy here. But does anybody have what they call a kedima? Does anybody have a priority? Any of them? The first one, you have the first one who saw it, the first one who offered it, and the first one who came up with the highest price. So you're arguing that they have no claim on you. There's no accepted offer. You can pick whoever you want. Okay. So there's no obligation. Their priority is in their own mind. It's their own social feelings because they saw it first. That's it. I think over who? Like, all right. What do you say? All right. Chloe brings up that this is trying to simplify, but in real estate, it's always like, as they say, is it an all cash deal? Or is it depending on them getting financing and all these different kinds of calculations? You want to say, Evan, you have any, what do you say? So you say pick anybody you want. Ain't nothing signed. That's it. Okay. So anybody the Zoom cashback? What do you guys say? Who do the Mills have to do? The Mills any obligation whatsoever?
Rabbi, I say they're not under any obligation whatsoever, but that I think their best option would be to come back and say to all three couples, "You all offered the same thing. Give me your best number."
Right. So that of course is what should happen. If assuming that they're going to, the people are going to move, that you say, look, we have three people at 360, ladies and gentlemen, the winner of the purchase is going to be somebody who's going to give us an offer, which is going to be the best offer. You could understand that, but let's say, we're trying to create a constructive case here to understand the idea is that anything that's happened to you binding on you, the seller. So agent says, and Evan, actually, pretty much everybody said, nothing signed. That's it. No ring on the finger. Right. No ring on the finger. Okay. All right. So here we go. So Shane and Bavakasha. Now we're going to get to some. This is very important to know. At what point is the ring? When is a commitment a commitment? Go on.
Halacha addresses various levels of commitment, replied Rabbi Dayan. Although a transaction requires a formal act of acquisition, kinyan, to be halachically binding, an upright person is expected to honor also his verbal commitment unless changed circumstances warrant otherwise.
Stop right there. That's a very important point. So halacha is a floor, not a ceiling. So halacha agrees with Adrian, which is that, and actually everybody, they need a formal kinyan. In real estate, what's a kinyan? A signed contract. Now that will be, by the way, let's call it industry specific. In the diamond industry, among Jews, which is not a small percentage of people who buy and sell diamonds, for them, a kinyan, what they call a kinyan de Medina, they will make deals on very expensive stones with a handshake. Like, I will buy that diamond for $20,000 and I'm shaking on it. That guy is halachically bounded because if that's what they call the Kenyan, the Minach HaSocharim, Halacha will say the kingdom will be based upon, except obviously if you give money, there's, except for the standard, there's a standard kinyonim. In other words, I give you money and I take the object, clearly, kinyon kesef, or a contract, kinyon shtar, contract, you signed it, that's the binding. But there could be additional kinds of kinyonim, and that will be based upon the minhag ha-socharim, whatever the industry standard of that industry. So let's say in diamond, I don't know if it's true, certainly for decades, it was a handshake. Minhag ha-socharim. A socher is a seller. It's the merchant's practice. So it goes based upon what is the industry standard. At that point, that's a real kinyan, okay? So certainly I assume that a signed contract is binding because you can take it to court, et cetera. So that's certainly a kinyan, kinyan shtar, that's a kinyan shtar. But there could be other kinyanim. Cash is always a kinyan, okay? It gives you cash and you accept the cash. In fact, you accept the cash. Well, the question, can you cash and it gives you the keys to the house? The house is yours. Well, verbal is not halakhically binding. It's not binding. Right. They were very careful. The millers were very careful to say, we've not made up our minds yet. They did not make a promise. As he said, it's ethically binding, but not halakhically binding in a Beit Din. So here's the deal. Halacha will go by, as I said, the minhag ha-socharim. So if that is binding in America, it will accept that as being that because that was what they call, that was the intent of the buyer and seller. We are operating within New York City real estate practices. And if that declaration, I'm not a lawyer, I don't know, if that actually is binding, they both say that, then that would be defensible both in American court and in the basement, okay? All right, let's go on. But now I want to point out but here's the key point. Notice there's two levels going on here. This is very important. There is a legalistic, minimalistic, did I transfer ownership to you? Yes or no? Or an upright person says, their yes is a yes and their no is a no, unless there's radical change of circumstances, which means that if you promise something, even though it's a verbal agreement, so forget about it, which is not binding in American in most circumstances, one as a moral person should do that. You know what I'm saying? The mishpat operates on the basic level, the basic minimalistic legalistic minimum, and then to be an ethical person, that you make a promise, you keep your promises. Okay, go on. Gina.
A person who does not uphold his verbal commitments is termed untrustworthy, mechusar amana, and the sages are not pleased with him.
All right, stop with that. So we say the word emuna. We have trust in Hashem. A mechusar amana means a person who is untrustworthy, which means basically this person is, they make promises and they don't come through. That's not a good status to have in halacha. Okay, that's you don't follow through in your promises. Only those things which are contracts. That is a disgraceful person. I understand now. So, all right. Chloe's pointing out. She's shaking her hand at it. Sadly, in many businesses, not in real estate. Right. Okay. So first of all, by the way, that's the basic point. What's the basic thing of it sounds very simple, but it's not so simple. What's the basic thing of having a good society? Your word is your bond. That's it. Okay, and that's what a person should aspire to be. And to be not that is a... So again, I'm bringing this up because a guy could get focused. This goes back to what I'm discussing with Scott. In other words, a person becomes observant in kashrut, great. A person becomes observant in Shabbat, great. I'm saying there's something which the Torah tells is also equally significant, is that when you make a deal and you promise and you're waiting for the lawyers to draft the thing, you're not going to be a weasel and try to then shtup in stuff that you didn't agree with in page 17, subsection 47, 48, 49, that fundamentally twists the deal in your favor, okay? That's a mechusram. 48.8 in super small font with a point, right? Okay? And let's be honest. You can't, it's not worth, yes, exactly. All right, so that's a very important point, okay? So this is, I picked these cases because it started speaking of a different mentality, how we relate to our fellow man economically. He did sell an Elohim, he has economic rights. I have to treat with him with dignity and integrity. And just because if I'm not going to be able to absolutely squeeze every red cent out of the guy. Okay? Now, what I'm telling you is sort of like so obvious, but it's rare. Okay? Anybody who's been in the biz world, you make the handshake and then you count your fingers at the end of the handshake, make sure you still got all five because you know what's going on out there, right? All right? So the bottom line is, people are going to do what they're going to do, but they can't take that fundamental. They can't allow you to remove your personal dignity, and your dignity is that you're a person who has a person of integrity. Ish emet. Let's keep on going.
Nevertheless, the Rishonim indicate that only if the parties already set a price is there an issue of mechusar amana. Some add that also other terms of sale were finalized.
Okay, so there's a difference here. In other words, if they set a price and he makes the promise to the person and he steps away, then he's a mechusar amana. Or they've worked at other terms. In other words, everything's been worked out. Go on.
Moreover, the Gemara indicates that even if the parties made a kinyan before there was an established price, it is not halachically binding, since without a set price, there cannot be a firm commitment, gemerut dat, since the parties might not agree on the price.
Right. So even if they did a kinyan, but unless there's a set price, even if they shook on it or they did other activities of a transaction, here, I'm going to give you $20,000 right now as a down payment. And that's no. Until there's a set price, it's gemerut dat, so then you can't say the guy made a commitment until he knows all the major elements here. Go on.
Thus, before agreeing on a price, there is no commitment to one another, not even a moral commitment on the level of mechusar amana. Thus, you are free to sell to whomever you want or to whoever will upgrade to a better offer, even if one couple saw and expressed interest first. In general, concluded Rabbi Dayan, the concept of first come, first served is a social concept rooted primarily in the common practice of implicit agreement between people to enable fair social orderliness. In the specific context of a private person selling his house, it is less applicable, but if you have no reason to prefer one over the other, it can provide a default guideline. Verdict, even if two parties express general agreement to sell one to another, until they set an agreed price, there is not even a moral obligation of mechusar amana.
Okay. So at this point, they could pick whatever they want. Now, the case here is that there are three Jews, though. There's another obligation above this. Behat rechemocha. Do to your fellows you want for yourself. So now you have a challenge because two people are going to be upset. So therefore, the best solution, what Shana says, like, guys, I love, I love all you guys. You're great, 360, but you're stuck at 360. I will take the price, whoever gets the highest price.
They did it like ASAP, whereas the other ones wait.
Or it's a second house for them, something like that.
Yeah, Yeah, so you can take other things into consideration, like love thy neighbor as yourself and other duties that you have to your fellow Jews. If someone needs it more, then I think there is a moral obligation.
Okay, so I want to share here. We have literally three levels of obligation here. So there's the first minimalistic halakhic obligation. Was there commitment? No commitment. No commitment. No obligation. Next one, I can't be mechusar aman. I can't be a person who's untrustworthy. But again, if there's no set price, I'm not untrustworthy because I'm not breaking a deal because there's no deal. Then there's hadrei chamocha, which is I have to love my fellow Jews. You can either say, if you guys are all stuck at the 360 number, I'm going to put three names in a hat, and I'm not going to show any preference, and I'm going to pick one out. Or let's say somebody, or you say better yet, the better option is that somebody can better offer a better price, be the highest. That's the first legit. Yes, Chloe. Yes. Yes. Yes.
How am I supposed to perform my job by giving advice to people? Like, taking into account halacha. Like, I'm representing my client, whether the buyer or the seller,
say
the buyer.
Okay.
And I know that the best strategy to help them to get what they want may not be halacha, like, love your neighbor like yourself, but like, really, like, presenting your best foot forward and, doing
the same thing. Well, no, you're
why not, like, am I not following
Allah because
I'm advising them to do something that they know would get them? Like, I would not tell them to do something. I'm not saying, like, something
devious. In the most broadest point, I had a friend. Here's a case. Who worked. This goes back to the 1980s at a camera shop, okay, which is notorious electronic camera shop, which might be the same situation, where all kinds of bait and switches were done. You present this Nikon camera as a new camera, really, it's a from the gray market or something. So basically, all kinds of, they say in Yiddish, shtickalach were done. He asked his Rosh Yeshiva, my Rosh Yeshiva says, part of the foundation of our business is basically a bait and switch and all kinds of like cutting the corners, right? Right? He says, you have to quit. You can't go to work and basically be a thief all day. Now, having said that, all right, but that doesn't mean that everybody who sells electronics has to sell it unjustly or real estate. You can be successful acting in a just manner. That's it. So I don't want to say in every situation, lying, cheating, deceiving, misrepresentation, give me a very specific case. Okay. Right. Right.
Knowing that they'll probably get a better offer on Sunday. This is where we're at to help them, make the sellers make the decision.
That's not a problem. You're allowed to. But again, they also know we can have another open house, and we might get lucky. So why should I take this price? I don't think that's a problem. Why is that a problem? In other words, they're going to, let's say the ask is 1.5 million, and they're going to come here at 1.2. Okay, you say, this offer is good till Friday, and that's it, take it or leave it. And they say, we're going to throw our luck with another open house, we'll have another showing. We got this great guy on YouTube who's going to walk through our thing and with a great video crew, and is going to talk about the beautiful fine Corinthian marble of this whatever, chvesnisht, whatever they're going to sell it as.
But even if the seller was handicapped and you're owning that, maybe the seller is handicapped and doesn't know about the weekend, you're being hired to provide a service. And so I think by providing the service, servicing your client, you're doing the right thing.
Now, you have an obligation to present your person's offer the best way. This is a cash offer. It's 1.25. I know you want 1.5. This is an offer. No, I understand that. Right, I understand that. Right, that's it. That's it. You know, you're not obligated to say, you know, no, you should really wait till Sunday because you might get a better, because that's his agent's obligation. You know, I don't think you have an obligation to do that. You know, that's it. All right, the goal here is to give you guys a little Baskin Robbins taste food. You know, when you go into the 31 flavor, you get a little taste. Hey, you know, I like this this chocolate peanut butter swirl ice cream. I want to share sort of what I wanted tonight was to show you a few ideas, two different cases, and a mentality of thinking about these areas in a little bit more rigorous way and to explore it. Certainly, if you're in a particular area of business, of real estate or law, there are halachic issues that are going to come your way in regularity, and you have an obligation to know the laws that apply to you because you want to be a just person. You know what I mean? You want to eat kosher, you want to keep Shabbat, you want to be a just person. They're all important. I'm not picking any favorite child, okay? So that's becoming a more committed Jew means also the mishpatim. You can't be like, I'm a Jew in shul, but in my mind, when I'm doing business, I could do all I want. No. Okay, that's the basic message. All right, guys, have a great night.
Just to kind of like circle back, because I feel like you've talked about so many different options.
Yeah.
What Shana said was the right thing to do to give everybody, you know, a chance.
Yeah,
to, like,
so number one, yeah,
one last chance to raise their.
Yeah, bid. Guys, we're at 360. I love you all.
If anybody 24 wants hours to see if you can come up with like a little bit more.
Right, no, I would not say a little more. Why would you again negotiating against yourself? Say, God, anybody can have a stronger offer. We'll get the house. Pause, and you have 24 hours to make the thing. Well, you know, send it on in.
That's what I thought.
That's it. All right, we got Rabbi Wilds, who's now going to show you some Tanya.